Hello and welcome to ARN. This is Paul Bromwell, and today I'm joined by the Hall of Famer, the founder of the Four Horsemen, the creator of the Spinebuster, one of the best tag team wrestlers to ever step inside the squared circle, and the man who didn't say the word no during his storied career. He's the enforcer. He's Double A. He's ARN Anderson. ARN, how are you this week?
Fantastic. I'm excited about this episode because the landscape of the wrestling business is fixing to change drastically.
You're absolutely right, ARN. And as I was doing my research for this show, I thought, you know what? This is a perfect opportunity to use some of what Conrad did. And for those of you that are not on ad-free shows, we're going to share with you some clips from his interview with the late Jim Crockett that will help best tell the story, and we'll get some reaction from ARN about why and how the transition out of Crockett for ARN and Tully, what that looked like. So ARN, I'm really looking forward to this one today.
So am I.
Let's do it. So last week we talked about the ending of the grueling Great American Bash Tour and the beginning of what could have been the most significant programs in wrestling history. And that, sir, is no bullshit. It's the number one and number two tag teams of the era and arguably ever. Think about it. The Horsemen and the Midnight Express. They're still tag teams. I know Dax Harwood, others that talk about the Midnights and you and Tully all these years later as being big time influences on wrestling performers today. What does that mean to you as far as hearing that some of those guys talk about what you and Tully and the Midnights meant to them?
Well, when you're as good as FTR and you get a compliment, number one, you know they mean it. You know, they're not just pulling your leg, and they are so good. You know, I think they're as good as any team of any era. They're just that good. They're incredible. And they happen to be good friends of mine, but still, it's, you know, they did. They copied Tully and I, and that's for us, or for me anyway, certainly for me, I was very proud that they did emulate us.
They emulated you. They have that Midnight Express-style music, and you could have plugged them right into that era, and they would have fit perfectly amongst all the, you know, those teams. So today, we're going to discuss the end of the line as you and Tully left Crockett and headed to the World Wrestling Federation. And before we run through your last 10 days in Jim Crockett Promotions, because that's what happened here, September of 88, I think it's crucial to address the state of Crockett to put this conversation in the proper context. So you and Conrad had discussed your departure from the company on the second episode of this show, which is available in the archives wherever you find your podcast. But since that time, new information, including Jim Crockett's interview as part of the Conversation with Conrad series, has shed some new light on the circumstances that led to the collapse of Crockett. And we're going to play those clips, as I said at the beginning. And from the interviews, I know we have folks listening today that may have never heard that interview. And ARN, I know you can agree, special programs like this one are a top of the list of reasons why it pays to be a member at ad-free shows. Am I right?
Yeah, you get, you know, really important stuff that may have been, you know, not out there. Because there was no social media. There was not, you know, every time somebody said something, it was all over social media. You know, there was some stuff that was behind the scenes and underneath the covers, and it would finally come to air, and you would go, oh, God, well, now I see why that happened or that didn't happen or whatever. It's, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you'll see some of the value of that as we go through this. And for those that are ad-free show members, you're actually going to see some video. We have a rare video that we're going to play, a video clip towards the end of the show, a bootleg video that you're going to see here as well of that famous match in Philadelphia, the last match for ARN and Tully together there. So here we go. I want to take this story back, ARN, to Starrcade 1987, where it really starts to begin. We have a series of events that culminated for you and Tully on September 10th of 1988 in Philadelphia. And as a reminder, this is when Vince created Survivor Series to compete directly against Starrcade, which was moved to Chicago that year as opposed to running Greensboro or even Atlanta. And as a result, Crockett moved Starrcade to the afternoon show. The power play by Vince, that is, threatening to withhold WrestleMania 4 from the pay-per-view providers, resulted in Crockett only getting 20,000 pay-per-view buys. Let me say that again. They only got 20,000 pay-per-view buys. Their Survivor Series, 300,000. So this first clip I'm going to play, Arn, Mr. Crockett shared his recollection of that event that led to the downfall of his company. And so here we go. Here's the interview with Conrad, and I want to play this and then get your reaction. Let's check it out.
Let's get back to Starrcade. This is Vince McMahon's death blow, where supposedly he takes great offense to you trying to venture into pay-per-view, which he feels like he's king of now on the heels of WrestleMania 3. It's a relatively new concept, and he's going to try to counter-program you and create Survivor Series as his secondary pay-per-view. And his original plan is to go head-to-head with your event. And you move to the afternoon trying to acquiesce. Certain cable systems want to present a joint offering where you could get both shows. He has no interest in that. And in fact, tells those cable systems, if you carry his event, you can't have WrestleMania 4. And a lot of them agree to that. Yep. So you had big, grandiose plans. You've now got control of Watts territory. You've created this big syndicated network. We've got contracts that have balloon payments coming due. Here's our big holy grail payoff, Starrcade 87. But Vince McMahon sabotages you.
Yeah.
And you only wind up pulling in around 20,000 buys. The show starts at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's priced at $14.95. By comparison, Survivor Series, the very first one, sold over 300,000 pay-per-views because of Vince's power play with the cable systems.
Yep.
Do you recall what your original expectations for Starrcade 87 were?
A lot more than 20,000.
I mean, you're having some financial issues within the business, some cash flow issues. You know you've got these big lump sums coming due. You had to have a forecast.
I don't remember the numbers, but they were big numbers and didn't come close. And it's like, you know, sailing. Somebody just pulled the wind out of the sails and you're dead in the water.
I saw an interview with your brother where he said when you guys got to the building in Chicago, and he didn't like the building in Chicago.
No.
When you got there, he could tell you were done. You had given up. I don't remember what it was about that day. Do you recall?
No, I think he's right. I think, you know, it just the handwriting on the wall, I finally said, it's there.
All right, so Arn, I have a follow-up question to that. Handwriting is on the wall. You've previously stated that Jim Crockett was aloof from most of the boys. He maintained a special relationship with Flair and Dusty based on what they meant to the promotion. But for you personally, did you see a burnout in management as early as Chicago of 87, or was this something that would have ever crossed your mind?
Well, there were some payoffs on previous big shows that we weren't paid what we were supposed to be. The big one was I was called in the bathroom by Jimmy Crockett, and he said, we've got this big pay-per-view coming up. He said, you guys have really worked hard. You're one of my guys that I depend on. You've done a hell of a job. I want to pay you $25,000 for this upcoming pay-per-view. I think it was the very first one. Okay? And when I got paid, it was not nearly that. It was, I want to say, and I've told it on different podcasts, I want to say it was like, what, 12?
Yeah, 11,700 was what I have in my notes.
Yep. So it wasn't even half. And, you know, when we talked to him about it, he just went, well, you know, Arn, I got a lot of bills and, you know, a lot of things I got to juggle right now. We're kind of in a pinch. I'll make it up to you. Well, I didn't go to him and say, what are you going to pay me? He came to me and said, this is what I'm going to pay you, right out of the blue. So when it's less than half of that, where's your confidence? You know, it's like, just don't tell me. If he had never said a word about what he was going to pay, and that's what I would have gotten, I'd have been very happy with that. That's a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money for a day's work in that particular time. But he came to me and, you know, he said, this is what it's going to be. And then when it wasn't, man, it just hits you in the stomach. And we were hearing rumors it was either one of two things are going to go down. Either TBS or Turner's going to buy the company, or we're going to go bankrupt. Well, when you hear that and you're a top player and you see that the other guy, Vince McMahon, is assembling an all-star team and he's getting every top guy from every territory to come there, you start going, hey, am I going to be the last guy without a life jacket? You know, if Turner doesn't buy the company and we go bankrupt, there's going to be a whole crew of guys sitting here very vulnerable. So that was something to consider. As far as we were concerned. Also, the Turner people had called in some of the top talent and asked them what they thought about the way the company was run in general and things of that nature. And Tully was one of those guys. And Tully being Tully, he told what he thought to be the truth.
Yeah.
Well, there's sometimes you don't just have to tell the exact truth. Sometimes you can dance around the truth and do, you know, what you think might be best for not only you, but for everybody around you. And when he said what he said, and that was a private conversation, wasn't received very well, which means Tully got taken off the private plane.
Well, and we're going to dig into all that. We're going to go a layer deep in all that conversation, because this is the whole story of why you guys finally made the decision to go.
Well, there was a boulder tumbling downhill, and
that's
we'll
right.
go ahead and talk about it as you've got
sure.
it laid out. But
yeah.
it wasn't a single event; it was several events.
Multiple. Yep. Yep. And I guess too, just kind of getting back to Jim Crockett and David saying, we knew as far back as Starrcade 87 that our goose was cooked, for lack of a better word. Could you kind of feel that from them? Did you kind of feel that from your leadership team, that they already kind of thought defeated and discouraged by the WWF?
Well, no, because I wasn't privy to those conversations.
Okay.
That was a family conversation and a Booker conversation that might have included JJ that didn't share that.
But it wasn't trickling down to you guys.
No, nope. we were still making money, you know.
Okay.
And let me preface this before we go any further. You know, I went to Jim Crockett Promotions, and I was just a few years in the business. And for the 3 years I was there, I made more money than I could possibly have ever dreamed, you know, that I would make, and more than I was worth out in the real world. That's for sure. So I had three really, really good years, 85, 86, 87. You know, I was able to buy a home, buy a couple of vehicles, furnish that home, take care of my family. You know, I went from zero to having some things in just really a three-year period. And I'm grateful to the Crocketts and the Crockett family and Dusty being the booker, you know, and using me for all that time. I'm not an ingrate.
Yeah.
Don't think I am. I was very thankful for everything that happened during those 3 years. I just wish it would have ended better.
Arn, we talked about the burnout in management around this time. Arn, in there, how did you hear about us, Box? So they know the founding father of the Four Horsemen sent you. So, Arn, we were just talking about this, and you mentioned it. The Jim Crockett promise of $25,000 for that pay-per-view payoff. You said, and we talked about it, you received less than half, $11,700. Based on the interview with Mr. Crockett, it seemed that this promise was actually for Starrcade, not the Bunkhouse Stampede, as we had talked about and has been talked about in previous episodes. But Conrad pressed Jim Crockett on this, and I have the clip here that I want to play for you, so let's take a listen.
But Arn Anderson recently has told the story about how he was upset with the payoffs, and he came to you and expressed some of those concerns. And supposedly you said, hey, I know that we haven't hit all the numbers we needed to this year. Or we hope to stick with me. Starrcade's going to be where we finally make some money. I'm going to pay you guys $25,000 a piece for that match. When they get their payoff in early 88, it's for $12,500. With no conversation. And I understand from the outside looking in as a business person well, gosh, you got a tenth or of what you thought you were going to get on pay-per-view. You were probably scraping just to get the 12-5 together.
Yes.
But Arn says he never had a conversation with you about that. And had you sat down and said, Arn, that was my best intention, but here's what happened with Vince. We're going to keep going with this thing. I'll make it up to you on the next one. And because there's no conversation, his feelings are hurt.
I'm sure his feelings were hurt, but I did not go back and say, hey, I failed on this side, so therefore I can't do this. I should have in hindsight. But
you know, we're going to talk eventually about how Arn and Tully would jump in 88. But when I really pressed him on that issue, what if he would have come, he being you, would have came to him and said, hey, that was my intention, but I couldn't do it, and here's why, and explained everything that went into Vince sabotaging the pay-per-view, that he would have stuck with you. Was it at the time you didn't feel like you could sort of show that vulnerability with the talent? Because you don't want everyone to leave, right?
No.
And if they start to hear, well, we can't make payoffs, now it feels like,
once you do that, it's like, you know, the rats are going to jump the ship.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's a run on the bank, so to speak. They're all gone.
Arn, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I never had a strong relationship with Jimmy, but, you know, I never had a cross word with him really either. It was just a couple of instances on like, you know, business related that I felt like I could ask him man to man. It hurts me to see him in the shape he is in when he's doing this.
This interview, yeah.
Yeah, he's a beaten man. When he's going back, you can tell he's reliving it.
He has nothing. Yeah, he doesn't know what to say.
I mean, what do you say?
Yeah.
I would have stayed with him as far as I go. If we would have had that conversation and he would have told me, hey, you know, Arn, this is what happened. I'm sorry. I told you I was going to, you know, pay you this, but it's just, hey, I'm just hanging by fingernails, you know. But he didn't.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just you get it and you see it and you're waiting on a conversation and one never comes. And then you start to see things like on the next TVs, which I'm sure we're going to talk about here in a little bit, you start to see things happening that would have never happened before.
Yeah.
So it's like, man, this is strange. What have I done to deserve this? I've done nothing but work my ass off. Whatever they said, like you said, couldn't say no. I never knew you could say no in this business. Whatever you asked, I'm going to get it done the best I can for you. But there were guys that at the right time did say no, and it benefited their career because the office knew they couldn't just steamroll them, run them over, treat them any way they wanted. And it was guys that were in a similar position that I was in. I just don't think we were viewed as critical.
Hindsight being what it is, do you look back at this, we're showing some of these clips now, and say, if I could have done it over, I myself would have been maybe a little bit more proactive and gone and talked to Jimmy? Or was that just a different era and that's just how you were supposed to act back then?
Well, I didn't know you could go have a conversation like that. I was there. I was paid to do a job, do it the best I could, you know, and that's it.
Okay. So we also know from what you and Jim and David Crockett and even Tully have said previously, this was also about the same time with issues with creative, and you kind of alluded to it just about a minute ago. So the week after Starrcade, Dusty made Luger the babyface with a turn coming as part of the Bunkhouse Stampede matches. Rather than booking Luger to win, Luger eliminated you and Tully to keep that program alive following the breakup with the Horsemen. Dusty, for his part, goes on to win this for the third time. And Tony Schiavone has told a story on what happened when, that after that show, Tully declared, why doesn't Dusty book Dusty so that he can beat Dusty? So in defense of the Horsemen, you guys are the hottest act in the company that can work a program with anyone up and down the card. We know Tully was a little bit more political and you were not. But did it ever concern you, Arn, that Tully battled the office knowing that he was your tag partner?
Did it concern me?
Did it concern you being attached to Tully that he was a political kind of speaking his mind lightning rod as you
were
his partner?
It did a little bit because, I mean, but now we were a team and that was a work. But it wasn't a work because we really were a team.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, we were company men. When I knew that he had went to the Turner people and said what he thought, even though technically could have been true, that's not the time or the place to say it. Yeah. You know, it would have been... If I would have been one of those guys that met with him, it would have been, hey, we got a strong crew. We got a hell of a work ethic. We know how to run a wrestling event, and we know how to build momentum. Look at the houses right now. Let's take a look at the Midnight Express numbers, you know. That's what I was hanging my hat on, man. We had flamed up, but I guess the debt... was absorbing, all the newfound revenue we were getting on that match. It was going to back debt.
That's right.
I mean, that's what you figure out later, because I went, God almighty, how are we in trouble when we're doing 13,000 here and 13,000 the next night? How can we possibly be in debt? Well, buying Bill Watts territory.
And we're going to get into some of that debt, too, in addition to the Bill Watts territory. So we move on from the Bunkhouse Stampede. I want to keep this going chronologically here. In the spring, you find out that that payoff you were promised, you told your wife about it, was less than half because of the failure of Starrcade 87 on the pay-per-view. Chronologically, this is about also the time the Horsemen added Barry Windham to the mix. And I want to pause here because we talked about how well Barry fit into the Horsemen in May of 88. And you indicated you were excited because Barry was new and fresh. Do you think that excitement helped subdue the heartburn and keep you from telling Crockett to pound sand right then and there about the payoff promise to you?
It was such a good fit. I felt like everything was new. Now, in the history of the business, there have always been guys who were in a particular match that were positioned to have a bigger payoff than what they should have gotten. It's always happened. Guys have been getting screwed on payoffs since the beginning of time. And then there was some matches you would have a small house, but you only had one single main event. And all of a sudden you got twice what you thought you were going to get. That's just the nature of the business. You know, it really is.
But at least with all this kind of going on, to the point earlier, it seems like, you know, you got Barry Windham joining the Horsemen. You guys are having more fun than ever, at least on camera, at least to us as fans. The Horsemen are clicking. They're riding high. You're wearing the tag team title belts, and things seem to be going well. So as much as kind of the pain, the heartache, the heartburn, as I said, of you not being paid what you should and that going right, it's got to feel good as far as how you're at least positioned in the company and things are working there.
I was looking for it. A 4 to 6 month run with the Midnight Express.
There you go.
To be able to get to all of the markets that we had, that would be waiting on that match, it was going to take 4 to 6 months, and that was going to be money.
Absolutely. So after Barry joins the Horsemen, all five of you ran 45-plus days. We've talked about it, the Great American Bash Tour 88. This tour was held in cities all across the country, but there was a lot of travel. Possibly by the private planes, yes, planes, because by this time Crockett owned two of them in order to deliver the advertised shows. Unknown to everyone outside the Crockett inner circle, these planes cost so much money that the company started using David Crockett's Diners Club card to float the bills, despite sellout after sellout in the arena every single night, as we mentioned. Arn, were you ever made aware, or did you ever discover that the company was hemorrhaging cash like this?
No, God, no. That was kept in a golden circle, I would think. Family, maybe Dusty knew about it. Maybe not, I don't know. But certainly it was kept within, you know, operating costs. I knew, I did hear this, just, and I think it might have been one of the pilots, and we got to be good friends. Freddie Floyd, Pat Jordan were the two, you know, pilots of the jet, and that's normally where we were on. It was the 10-seat jet. And he said back then, I just remember him saying, hey, this thing costs $4,500 an hour to operate.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay, so let's say it's 3 hours away. Do the math, $13,500 for the jet before you pay any payoffs or any, if there's anything else involved, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Before you got to get all that out of the way before anybody gets paid. So,
my goodness. And they got two of them going. So at this point, so double it. And man, it's no wonder what was going on here.
Well, and the Gulfstream wasn't, you know, it wasn't as nearly as, because it was a prop plane. It was, but it was a big prop plane. It wasn't nearly as expensive to operate. And if we would have just bought that one plane and stuck with it, and your top 16 guys got on that plane, and hey, there was going to need to be some guys flying coach. But you couldn't do that if you're booking all over the place. So there was some, you know, the choices of the towns and skipping around. That's two planes hopping around to those towns.
Well, Arne, here we are. It is September 1st. I wanted to make sure that we kind of colored in some of the backstory of where your head is, kind of what's going on behind the scenes that brings us to this September. And the Horsemen and the Midnight Express continue the feud that kicked off some 3 weeks earlier. You were hoping for 5 to 6 months. We're definitely not going to get that, unfortunately, with you guys. But you're in Raleigh. It's September 1st. You and Tully fought the Midnight Express to a no contest. And Arne, I'm sure that both you and Tully would have preferred to go over that night as opposed to ending yet another match in a no contest. And fellas, we go
one
on.
Second.
Yes, sir. Sure.
Let me just a little food for thought.
Uh-oh.
That can have more than one connotation right there, pal.
Armed Anderson. I love it. That's all you need to know when it comes to Blue Chew. So be armed like Arne Anderson.
Check.
So, Arne, we move on. It's September 2nd, and Crockett is back recording television from Norfolk. And once again, the Midnight Express wrestled the Horsemen in a no disqualification match. This time, the Horsemen came out on top with the assist from Wyndham. And then you travel up the road on September 3rd from Baltimore, Maryland. Beautiful Baltimore, Maryland there, the Inner Harbor. It's the semi-main event of the evening. And you're not kidding. We've talked about how many fans. You got 11,000 fans watching the Midnight Express and Horsemen fight to a double disqualification. You pack your bags. You maybe get a little rest. You maybe get some food. And now you're in Detroit on the 4th, the very next day. You have 7,500 fans there in Detroit. They're treated to the same match, same outcome. And Arne, guess what? You're going cross-country, sir, because the West Coast wants it as well. They want the action. It's the 5th of the month, and you're in Seattle. So you just talked about it on last week's episode. You're crossing time zones on back-to-back days, and you would lose a steel cage match to Luger, Nikita, and the Road Warriors. And we haven't talked much about Seattle. We mentioned it last week. Was this match on the card to give the fans the best, you think, of what Jim Crockett had to offer at this point?
Well, we had been there roughly a month earlier, right?
Yes, you had.
That's just too soon. Yeah. That's a mistake. There's no way to paint that as being a smart move. You just don't go back that quickly. You just don't.
Warren, between this show and Seattle, and the show in Houston that we're about to discuss, the significance of the whole private plane discussion becomes extremely important to this month, to this month's story, because this is when the upper management of Crockett kicked Tully off the plane. You've said time and time again that the private planes were critical to making towns. The Horsemen are on the marquee everywhere. They go, everywhere they go, and there's no better shit-talking, ass-strutting heel than Tully Blanchard. He was the flashpoint for much of what we saw on television from 85 to 88. Tully Blanchard Enterprises, the introduction of Baby Doll, subsequently JJ, mega feuds with Magnum, Dusty, the Road Warriors, and others, and of course the formation of the Horsemen, and still, management kicked Blanchard off the plane. Tully has stated that he was asked direct questions by Turner representatives were doing due diligence for the pending acquisition of JCP. You had mentioned it at the top of the show. What Tully said got back to the upper management, and David Crockett told him he was off the plane. Arn, I spent the time laying this out because I want you to spin some reality for 1 minute and answer this question. How in the hell could it possibly work if you're flying in the private plane, Tully's flying commercial, and you have a double shot in back-to-back days in four different cities in four different states? What did that even look like back then?
Was Tully on all of those shots?
After this event, he would still be teaming with you, tagging with you, and still expected to work.
Two double shots back to back?
That's correct. Do you remember anything about what his travel looked like back then? I know this is a long time ago.
No, I don't even know how he could have pulled it off.
Yeah. But that's just something as I was going through this. I'm like, how in the world would Tully, I know this was a short time because you guys are about to hit the bricks, but still interesting to think about because he's gone. He's no longer on the plane. Anything that you want to talk about? Actually, let's do this. Conrad asked Jim Crockett about what transpired on the plane, and we do have that piece of audio. So let me play it for you, and then I do have some questions for you. So let's check this out. Let's hear what Jimmy Crockett had to say.
Okay.
The rumor and innuendo is that a lot of the Turner folks were wanting to do some due diligence on the deal, and part of that involved talking to talent.
Yep.
Supposedly, you gave Tully Blanchard the heads up to talk to him and to be truthful, but then allegedly you were upset at some of the things he said, and you let him know that he was off the jet. And Tully tells it that he wanted to quit right there on the spot. So that night, he and Arn called their old pal Barry Darso and arranged a meeting with Vince the next day at his house. And then they returned to Philly that afternoon and gave notice. What do you remember about the falling out with Tully?
I don't remember any conversation about telling him to say anything to the Turner people at all. The Turner people went behind my back in most cases to talk to the talent without my knowing that they were talking to Rick, Dusty, whoever.
Yeah.
Okay. The fact that, you know, he set up a meeting with Vince, and I think Tully just saw that was tired of the dusty roads and finish, quote unquote, and jumped ship.
Were you surprised they gave notice?
Not really, because I mean, the rumor was out that we were selling. Therefore, there's going to be a lot of changes.
Mm-hmm.
Who's saying who's doing what? Dusty probably positioned that he was going to be the king bee, and Rick was probably positioned that he was going to be the king bee, and everybody else is wondering, where does that leave me?
Right.
So I don't know. And Vince says he'll do this, I'm leaving.
Hmm. All right, so let's dig into that a little bit. There was no denial about throwing Tully off the plane, but Arn, after listening to Jim's response, do you believe that Turner spoke to people without his knowledge?
Nope. I don't believe that.
Yeah.
I believe to have full disclosure for the Turner people to not be suspicious of anything, there had to be a conversation that between Jimmy and them, and Jimmy and the talent. If Jimmy didn't tell the talent, hey, to be truthful, then somebody would have slipped up, and the Turner people would have saw through it. I think.
Yeah.
I think everyone had to be on board with that conversation. They just had to be. But I think they were planning, they being Jimmy, on the guys either being smart enough or whatever you want to call it, or deceptive enough or just tell the truth. If they would have asked me, I would have said, hey guys, we just did two houses, 13,000 back to back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would have just told the truth. Hey, business is good. We have a strong, like I said earlier, work ethic. We have a strong crew. We have a really good crew of guys, and, things are picking up. Things are firing up again. And you're going to be buying a product that you're going to be glad you did.
One last piece of business on this topic. It's been speculated, asserted, declared that there were key players, including Rick and Dusty, that Turner wanted to lock down as part of the acquisition. For the members of our audience that don't know, how many Turner executives approached you and Tully about the buyout, the future, anything in general? Do you remember?
None approached me.
None. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't have a conversation with anybody. Tully did. And I don't know why that was, but I was happy with that they didn't ask me. Now, there's a pivotal point where Tully had probably already decided when he took off the plane that he was leaving anyway.
Yeah.
The Houston show, which is a TV taping, correct?
Yes.
The night before we turned in our notice, the next night. Do you have any notes on that?
I do. Because, I do. We're coming down to that next. Yeah.
Okay. Because that's the straw
that's
that broke
key.
The camel's back. That's
yes, sir.
The one. That's the biggie. So.
Yep. I guess it's safe to say here, though, there was a lot of uncertainty at this point, and it was paired with a souring relationship between you and Tully and JCP's management at this point, right?
I was back at, other than having my own gripes, my own individual gripes, which I did, I was still going to back up my partner. If he was leaving, I was going to leave with him.
There you go.
Because that's how tight we were, you know?
Gotcha. So September 7th is here. It's the third Clash of Champions, and it takes place from Albany, Georgia. And the main event of the show was Sting versus Barry Windham. Arn, you, Tully, and Rick were not even on that show. The company is going through so much turmoil at this point, but the administration left three of the most important wrestlers off the card. What are your thoughts as you kind of think about that now? You're not even on Clash of the Champions 3, the three of you.
How does that even happen?
How does that even happen? Exactly.
I can't reason as to why that made sense in somebody's head. All I can tell you, how does that even happen?
Mm.
Because it's so far-fetched.
Speaking of poor planning and preparation for a major event here on Jim Crockett Promotions' part, where they're leaving major players off the show, it resulted in a less than optimal outcome for the company. Arn, no one wants to get knocked on their ass by life's hardest hits. Arn, this is it. We need to speak about it. It is September 9th at the Sam Houston Coliseum. 3,000 people watched you and Tully fight the Midnight Express to a double DQ in a match second from the top. Now, as you've shared on the second episode of the show, what follows became the tipping point. You just alluded to it as we talked. You and Tully, you tear the house down with the Midnights. Following the match, you were told you were going to wrestle UWF stalwart Dr. Death, and you were to lose in 4 minutes. Now, Arn, you're on record putting Doc over, talent, strength, and ability, summing it all up that he was all man. But if I have this correct, you and Tully burned the house down with Stan and Bobby only for you to go out and get beaten up by the doctor. Is that correct?
Yep. And it had nothing to do with Doc. It just had to do with the fact that we gave the Midnight Express what the audience had paid to see, and that's the match that sold the tickets all over the country. Just look at the numbers. We went out and we fought those guys tooth and nail, and we got that angle and that match over. To me, to turn around and go out and get beat a few matches later, I didn't ask why. It wasn't my reason to ask why, but it tipped me over the top. It just made no sense, and it shit all over the Midnight Express. We had just fought those guys for 20-some minutes, dead even, and now a guy just comes out, and basically it was just an enhancement match.
So to be clear for you, after a tumultuous year, you're finally done. Arn, tell our listeners the thought process on how the call to Barry Darso and subsequently Vince McMahon went down.
Basically, we, Tully, I guess, would have taken a commercial flight to Philly that morning. But when I came back, he said, man, this is bullshit. It was like I should have been the one fussing at him about what just happened, but he was fussing at me. He said, man, this is bullshit. This is just getting worse and making no sense. He said, let's get out of here. So I said, okay, when I get to Philly, I'll call Barry Darso and we'll see what's going on. Barry had sent me, during the course of the time he first started there, in the course of probably a year and a half, 2 years, he had sent me a couple of messages. Vince would really like to have you guys. If you ever decide you want to leave, he'd really like to have you guys. Well, that night I called him and I said, I know this is kind of abrupt. We're ready. No shit. Okay. I'll get back in touch with you. Stay by the phone. So I stayed by the phone. In about 10 minutes, he called back. He said, you and Tully will have tickets at the airport at whatever time it was, 9 o'clock, 9 a.m. or something. You'll fly to Newark or whatever airport it was. Vince will have a limo there to pick you up. He's going to bring you to his house and talk to you guys. You're all set. Okay, when Tully got in the next morning, he had already had a message from me from the night before. I found out where he was staying. And I called him as soon as he got there. I want to say it might have been 11 o'clock because he had to have time to fly and get there. It was like maybe 11 a.m. We're supposed to fly to Newark or wherever it was. And we went out to Vince's pool and sat around. He had lunch for us. And he had a unparalleled way of making you feel good about yourself in those days. He knew all the facts, figures, numbers, knew everything about your career, the whole thing. And basically just when we left there, we were floating off the ground. And he said, you know, our one question was to him, hey, you know, I know you don't do guaranteed contracts. He said, no, I don't. We just kind of figure what kind of a spot do you have for us? He said, what did you make last year? We told him, he said, I guarantee you, you'll make more than that. Yeah, my word.
Mm.
Well,
that had to feel good. Yeah.
Well, yeah, everything was handshake deals and in those days. So we went back, went to the Marriott, and killed whatever time we had. And when we got to the building, about an hour beforehand, we went in. And I think it was probably just me. I don't really remember if Tully went in with me, but I went in, saw, knocked on Dusty's door, and went in, just went, hey, this is the hardest conversation I've ever had. I appreciate everything you've done for me and my family, but we're going to turn in our notice. And he's just kind of staring a hole through me like disbelief. I said, I'll put Bobby over. I'll do the honors to Bobby with that leg drop off the top. Not a problem. 1, 2, 3 in the middle. But we're going to finish up tonight. Okay. And I walked out and we kind of found a locker room to ourselves and we stayed there till time to go to the ring. And we went out and had our match and, did what I said I would do, and that finished us up.
Mm.
What a pop when Bobby got that 1, 2, 3.
Now, here we go. So, Arn, I got something for you. I don't have the audio, but it's the video because the audio is so super sketchy. But we're in Philadelphia. It's the semi-main event of the evening. 6,532 people. And the Midnight Express get the win over the Horsemen. The finish is creative. It saw Stan pinned by Tully after the slingshot suplex. And you were pinned by Bobby Eaton after the Alabama Jam, as you just spelled out to Dusty, exactly what you wanted to happen. And you and Bobby were the legal men, so the pin counted for the Midnight Express. And they won the tag team champions, becoming the first team to hold both the U.S. and NWA tag team titles. So here we go. We have the finish, and this will be the final clip for this week. There were no TV cameras at this show, and this is a bootleg from a fan who snuck a video camera into the Philadelphia Civic Center, and this is the only footage that exists. It's a tough to watch. It's poor video quality, but this is a historical piece of video that really shouldn't be allowed to exist. So we're going to watch it together, and Arn, you can just kind of talk about it. There's no sound. But if you're an ad-free shows member, you're going to be able to see this exclusively here on the show. So here we go. I'll go ahead and cue it to it. And here you guys are. Bobby just rolled into the ring. And is this the first time you're kind of seeing this bootleg video, Arn, of this ending of this match?
Never seen it before.
Yeah. So this is the Philadelphia Civic Center. There you are on the outside of the ring holding up the four fingers. Tully's inside. And it looks to be Tommy Young out there making the count.
That would be Tommy.
Yep, and here comes Bobby Eaton into the ring. But this is, I guess this is your final match ever with Tully and Jim Crockett, right? Or WCW.
Yep. Yeah, this is it. This is the last time.
Big knee, he tags you in. You're the legal man now. And here you come in, shot to the gut on Bobby. There he goes with that that bulldog-like maneuver. Jim Cornette at ringside on one side. You can see him there. But, man, it's sketchy video, but it is kind of cool this guy was able to sneak a camera into the arena for us.
Yeah, it was.
Yep. And this is just the last few minutes here as we're going into the end. Sweet stand with the elbow to Tully coming off the ropes. And there you are on the outside with Bobby mixing it up. But you're right, Arn. I think one thing I want you to pay attention to is the crowd. You won't hear him, but you'll see him once you drop the titles to the Midnight Express.
They were expecting to have another double count out, double DQ or something of that nature.
And there's Bobby. He set you up for it. You're laying in the middle of the ring. He's climbing to the top of the ropes. And there goes Tully for the slingshot. Alabama jam done. Slingshot suplex done. Double cover. Tommy Young right in the middle. 1, 2, 3. And then he's going to go over and tell him the Midnight Express just won the match. Crowd's not sure yet. Just bringing back some memories for you.
Oh, yeah. Once Tommy took the titles to them, that place
there it goes. Look, there it is.
Look at that pop.
Look at the crowd. Bananas. Wow.
You know, I just remember laying there and I was thinking, well, my life has changed forever. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that's fun. That's fun. Talk about it a little bit after this. You and Tully just took the pin. What are you thinking, talking about? You head back to the locker room. Take us through that.
Well, it just reaffirmed. We knew that we were the best team in the world. We knew that we were over and red hot as champions and as horsemen. And when you get a pop like that in your heels and you get beat for the titles, it means people are ready to see you get beat. And it means you're over. I don't want to be pompous and just say we're over, but we were over. Because you wouldn't get a reaction like that if we weren't. And we came upstairs. We had our own locker room. Nobody came in except, you know, Tommy the referee. And he kind of had a tear in his eye. And we made sure we didn't see anybody that night. After the match, because I don't know what I would have said to anybody. I feel like we kind of screwed Barry a little bit, JJ, and left them kind of on their own. Because the reality is, once we left, Horseman never recaptured that glory.
Exactly right.
It was never the same.
It was never the same. You go from the end of 85 to September 88. Horseman ruled the NWA and Jim Crockett Promotions. Looking back at this run, you guys were cooking with peanut oil, my friend. Business was white hot, sellout after sellout. Still, mistakes made along the line that lead to the fall of Crockett. For the record, 2 months later, the Crockett sold the company to Ted Turner. Final thoughts, memories, reflections, or anything else you feel like sharing about the day the music died, my friend?
Well, there's so many what-ifs and so many business mistakes. You know, as a performer, I don't know that we could have done any more than what we did to benefit that company. I think it was a huge mistake to buy Bill Watts territory. It was a huge mistake to buy Kansas City. I mean, what were you really buying? It was two dead companies. And when you have, other than, I think what you bought with Bill Watts was just his syndicated time slots is really all you bought, because the territory was dead. And to try to go out there and run those towns, we could have done it off of TBS.
Yeah.
We didn't need the syndicated shows. You know, that was the one huge mistake. Whatever he paid for those two territories, if you would have kept that in the slush fund to keep that company operating, I think it was a huge mistake, which we can always look back on this, not to have any marketing. You know, can you imagine?
Action figures, T-shirts, all that good stuff, too.
The guy up north was doing it. Why we wouldn't have just followed his lead and you know, did the same thing? Because if you combined all that, and we would have had someone to sit down with the map that was in charge and book the towns where they made sense, where there were short jaunts, where we weren't skipping back and forth across halfway across the country. I just think that we made a lot of mistakes, that if anybody would have had just some knowledge of travel and all that, that would have helped us quite a bit too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what an incredible run for Jim Crockett. From 85 to your departure, you were part of something so special, Arn. You said it in your retirement speech on Nitro in August of 97. Whether you love me or you hated me, know that when you purchased a ticket to watch Arn Anderson wrestle, you got everything I had that night. And truly, before the company folded, Crockett got the best from Arn Anderson. And in a lot of people's opinions, they didn't recognize what they even had right in front of them, my friend. The Horseman couldn't work without you or Tully Blanchard. And that's going to conclude us here for September 1988. What a pivotal month for you and your career. Next week, it's you and Tully moving to the great to the north and to the WWF, where you have a new boss, a new schedule, a new manager, and the creation and the arrival of the Brainbusters. I know you'll be looking forward to talking all things of your first month there in the WWF.
Well, like I said, I was grateful for the Crockett years. It benefited me financially, for me and my family, and I'm very thankful for that. I'm still in Charlotte, North Carolina. It gave me a new home.
It did.
You know, this is my home now, and it feels like I've been here my entire life. And I was just glad to be a part of it. It was what I call the glory years.
That's right. Like Bruce Springsteen said, glory days. There you go.
And I believe it.
Yep. And you know what? All these years later, people want to listen to it and talk about it and podcast and then listen to this show to hear all about it, man. So it's just so cool how it's burnt, you know, so many fond memories in so many people's minds, what you were able to accomplish back in those days. So, Arn, that's going to wrap us up for this week, man. I'm looking forward to hearing about what all happens that first month in the WWF. So on behalf of the great Arn Anderson, the legend, this is Paul Bromwell. We're going to see you right back here next week again on Arn. Take care, everybody.